This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. On November 15th, 1976, Art McNally, the director of officiating, watched a Monday night football game between the Dallas Cowboys and the Buffalo Bills. He was equipped with a stopwatch and a video camera. Why was this significant, you ask? Well, it's because this moment would be the dawn of something that would end up becoming Instant Replay.
Welcome to the Football History Dude Podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. Your host is Arnie Chapman. Football is his passion, and he wants you to come along with him to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board his DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour. Great Scott.
This time, as we step off the DeLorean, the date is October 8th, 2020. We're in the Football History Dude's office because we got a confession to make. Why are we here? I wish I had a revelation type of a story for you, something that's just going to knock your socks off. But unfortunately, it's quite the opposite. Because you see, when I had this interview, it was a great interview with Dave Burkett of the Detroit Free Press and the Detroit representative for the Pro Football Hall of Fame voters. Well, something happened. Technical difficulties, I guess. It did not work. So we lost that recording. It was very cool. There's some things I'll tell you about. But then, even when I thought all hope was lost, Dave was gracious enough to come back on again to talk some football. So that's why I brought up that 1976 Monday Night Football game. Art McNally was armed with a stopwatch and a video camera, working with his crew. So when there was a play and there's something that they weren't for sure about, if it should have happened that way, they're like, let's test this thing out. How long would it take us if there was a play that we're not sure about, review it, then get it back to the field to see if it's something that we should potentially change? Thus, the birth of Instant Replay. And thankfully, I'm able to press that Instant Replay button here for you too. But first, I'll give you kind of like a, I guess you'd call it a Cliff's Notes version of what we discussed in the first interview. I asked him at the very top of the interview, what was it like to be a better athlete than Ray Lewis, who, by the way, is my favorite non-Detroit Lions player of all time? Of course, when I asked him that question, because that's a silly question, he looks at me crossways and he's like, what are you talking about? The reason why I talked about that or asked him is he climbed Mount Kilimanjaro when Ray Lewis tried it and he had an injury or something like that. And he failed. So, not saying that he's obviously a better athlete than Ray Lewis, but it was just kind of an interesting story when I did some research. We also spoke about his knack for getting into sports writing, as in the reason for it, following his hero Mitch Albom as a Detroit legend, and how he would always pretend to writing for the games when he was a young, young puck there. He gave me some insight into what it's like to be the one that submits the Hall of Fame player, which is in Calvin Johnson this year. He was going to take my DeLorean back to the 57 championship game to be a reporter. What did he say the second time? Oh, I'm just going to have to let you figure that out. We'll let you get into this interview. Other than that, there's some other intertwining conversations that we bring back into this episode as well. Well, for you, the first episode. And that's me. I'm going to tell you what, I'm going to sign off for the Dumb Dumb of the Week move. I'm out of here. Let's get on with it. But again, before I go, this week's guest is Dave Burkett of the Detroit Free Press. Here's his bio from the Free Press website. A three-time Michigan Sports Writer of the Year, Burkett has covered the Lions for the Free Press since August of 2010. He was named one of America's top 10 beat writers by APSC in 2017, is a multi-time Michigan AP Award winner and tied for first place in Best Feature Writing category by the Pro Football Writers of America in 2017. A Pro Football Hall of Fame voter, Burkett previously covered the Lions and Michigan State football and also basketball for the Oakland Press and AnnArbor.com, which, for local homegrowns, that's MLive.com. I included links to some of his work over at the website, which, by the way, you can get to the website through your podcast player or by heading straight to SportsHistoryNetwork.com. Also, while you're at it, I ask that you please take some time to rate and review the podcast and subscribe for free to the show by mashing that little subscribe button, your podcast player choice. That way you get the hottest, freshest out the press episodes, well, each and every week. But for now, let's press that rewind button, instant play button, whatever it is, and let's try this bad boy again with Mr. Dave Burkett.
Against against the Saints because there's all that news about Corona possibly happening or not or whatever. Like, what happens for you normally on a Sunday like that?
Well, last week, you know, I woke up. I didn't see the news the night before when I'm broke, you know, midnight, something like that. I had fallen asleep. So I don't know what time. I'm usually a fairly early riser. So I was probably writing a story at 7 a.m. last week, you know, at least reaching out to people to make sure the game was still on. When I got that response back, wrote a story. And then, you know, I mean, look, if it's a home game, you know, I'm around, hang with the kids for a little bit in the morning, make them breakfast. They tend to sleep a little bit late, but I'll get some of the things set up ahead of time, before I go to the stadium that I usually do at the stadium. That's just creating the files for all the stories I'm going to write for the day, both in the system that we use and like a Microsoft Word document, just to sort of, you know, eliminate 15 minutes of busy work for myself when I get to the stadium. You know, the pandemic being what it is, there's no traffic obviously at the stadium. So I have a little more, it's a little easier to get in and out. But you know, I still get to the stadium, you know, let's say 2 hours ahead of time, depending on what's going on, it may be a little bit more. But you know, that way I can watch a little bit of what's happening on the field. Some of the pregame warmups, get some food in my system. You know, not that there's anyone to say hi to these days, which is why I'm getting there a little bit later than normal. But, you know, there's some Lions people that occasionally you'll run into, that it's good just to say hi to in person. So that's kind of the pregame setup of a home game.
When you went into this, you know, going from being a fan to actually being a reporter, what was the difference being on the field and, you know, talking to the players and being able to like watch it in different kind of perspectives?
Well, that's funny. I'll tell you a story. You know, I was, some of my buddies had some, you know, Lions season tickets. This was probably, you know, the first year they were at Ford Field. And, I remember going down to a game, you know, me and three buddies and, you know, I think we were sort of in zone. I don't remember exactly what was happening on the field, but you know, everyone around me is sort of standing up cheering. And my buddy, Jim, he looks over at me, smacks me on the shoulder. He's like, why aren't you up, you know, cheering? And I was sort of watching it like a reporter does at the time. You know, I'm just kind of sitting there. I mean, you know, you obviously don't react to much as a reporter, but I'm sort of watching who's coming in and off the field, you know, what packages they have on. And so this was, you know, 18 years ago. So you know, for the vast majority of my life, since college, I have just watched sports in a totally different, you know, fashion. And you have to do that for your job. But it's also, you know, the thing that built the love in sports for me was playing them as a young kid, watching them as a young kid, watching them with my dad, my brother, whatever the case was. And so I don't have the same, when I'm home, I try to, you know, my son loves sports, any sport for that matter. And, you know, so I'll try to watch a game with him just so he has, you know, that experience that I had when I was young. But I certainly don't cheer for a game or a play or a person like I did when I was little.
Right. Yeah. I mean, let's jump back into your younger days and talking about your, I don't know, I guess we'll call it your origin of becoming an NFL reporter. What was it like through that?
Yeah. You know, as I told you before, you know, I grew up kind of knowing that I wanted to stay involved with sports. You know, I was a big sports fan, heavily involved with sports, growing up and, playing them, you know, enjoying watching them, going to games, everything. And, so that's sort of how I got into the business was that, you know, I figured I had to do something in sports. So it didn't feel like a real job and it was either coach and teach or, you know, do this. And fortunately I got into this and, you know, when I started, off in the business, you know, again, I think it's just something that gets ingrained in your head early on that you're not a fan. You know, you can't be a fan. You can't have rooting interests. And that's tough for some people to believe, but it's the honest to God truth, I think, for the vast majority of reporters that, you know, we don't necessarily care who wins or loses. We want to have a great story to write about. It makes our life easier when the team we cover wins. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, we want to have good content and tell good stories of good people that we get to work with.
Speaking of great stories, do you have one that came to mind that, I don't know, of course, maybe not something that was mainstream that out of nowhere blew you like, oh, this is going to be a great story. And then it turned out for you.
Well, you know, I may have told you before, my favorite stories that I've ever written were when I went to Mount Kilimanjaro with John L. Smith. He was a Michigan State football coach at the time, and he was going to Africa with his family, first on an African safari and then climbing Mount Kilimanjaro with his boys. And I sort of asked him if I could come along, and he was like, yeah, come on. And, you know, so just long story short, I pitched it. My, you know, I was at the Oakland Press at the time, and it was going to be a little too costly for them, but I pitched it to a number of magazines, and ESPN, the Mag, told me they'd pay me to go. It was an amazing experience. And that was one that I certainly, envisioned being a good story, you know, just the opportunity to do that and to tell somebody's story. So maybe that doesn't fall totally into that, but that was one of them. Investigative pieces. Those are ones that you never know what you're going into, in how they're going to turn out to be. There's a big 4-part series I did on some kids from Pontiac that were part of their state championship basketball team, played football, went to college, you know, smaller colleges, lost their scholarships, came back and essentially entered the drug world selling drugs. And I remember going down to prison with one of the kids and spending like 5.5 hours as he basically told me his life story and, you know, how to make drugs. I mean, everything. And so it went a lot deeper than just these guys and sort of what was going on in Pontiac at the time. So that was one that I had no idea what I was getting into, until I got in there. And then, you know, certainly there's other stories that it's not until you actually sit down with a person. Tim Shaw, that's a story that comes to mind, when he let me spend a day with him early in his fight against ALS. And one of the things we did was I went with him to sign his living will. And it was just sort of a powerful, you know, moment. So things like that, that you never know exactly what you're going to get. I just wanted to spend a day with him, and he ended up taking me to his attorney's office in Nashville. And, so those are certainly some of the, you know, the more powerful stories, I guess, that I've been able to tell.
Yeah. The more, I guess you could say human interest side of things, which is really what sports at the core is, really teams, people working together for a common goal. I mean, you mentioned the Mount Kilimanjaro in our last episode. I talked about how, you know, I joked about you being a better athlete than Ray Lewis, who, by the way, is my favorite non-Detroit Lions player of all time. Like, I grew up, so in high school, linebacker and such, that was when they were the heyday of the 2000 Ravens. And just, I happened to be, you know, I clung on to him probably because of commercials too, and his such passion that he portrays through the game. Yet, were you ever able to talk to him?
To Ray Lewis? You know, I probably had a scrum at a Super Bowl, but I don't have any recollection of talking with Ray Lewis specifically. Maybe, you know, whether he was playing or as a broadcaster, you know, the Super Bowls are basically set up like you're not getting any one-on-one access, right? There's 5,000 reporters there, and every day players are available, but they're essentially on these risers, and, you know, it's groups of people or sitting at tables. And so, you know, and same thing, they bring out some of the media talent for the network that's broadcasting the game, or NFL Network or Sirius or whatever it may be. And so I imagine in some of those scrums, I've had an opportunity to talk to him, but nothing one-on-one, nothing that stands out. I don't have any good stories about your guy for you.
No, that's okay. I understand. I guess right now the best story we can have is, so the past 2 years for the Hall of Fame induction ceremony, we got press passes, and we take, it's a family affair, my brother, my dad, and myself. And the year that he got inducted, which is my first year into the Hall of Fame, is a press pass. And we're in the press conference, just like you said, there's like 5,000 people want to talk to him. I'm not available because I'm this little dude in the background. I'm just like, okay, we're not going to try to get him. But on the way out, there's the little placards. It's just like a folded up cardboard piece with his name on it. My dad goes in and steals it off of the chair and rips it in half. So each, my brother and I, have something from Ray Lewis's Hall of Fame. It's something they were going to throw away anyways. It's not like we're breaking too many laws. I can say this over the airs and everything, and I probably did multiple times because I'm kind of proud of it. I have this piece of Ray Lewis's Hall of Fame weekend. And speaking of Hall of Fame, you know, we talked about it before, but as a Hall of Fame voter, what makes a person in your eyes a Hall of Famer?
Yeah, look, to me, a Hall of Famer is, and it's not always easy distinguishing between, you know, sometimes they say the Hall of Fame and the Hall of Very Good, right? There's some very good players that aren't or won't be in the Hall of Fame. But to me, I typically look at, I want the, you know, the guys that I'm voting for, when they come up, if I see their name and I say, you know, that was one of the best players at his position for whatever, some period longer than a year of his career, right? He was one of the best quarterbacks for that 3-year stretch in the NFL. You know, he was an MVP candidate for all three of those years. You know, he was the best left tackle in the game for 5 years, you know, or one of the very few that were in that conversation. To me, that's a Hall of Famer. That's very subjective, much more so than the numbers. But I think the eye test is important when it comes to, you know, casting that Hall of Fame ballot, that you can see a player and you can say that guy is so dominant that he helps define his era, his position for some period of time.
And speaking of that, maybe that's a good segue. We can talk about Hall of Fame versus Hall of Very Good, or maybe not even very, very good, but let's talk Hall of Fame. So this year is a huge one for the Detroit Lions. Megatron, everybody knows that I'm a huge Detroit Lions fan. And you have a special, unique perspective on this. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, no, I so 48 voters, obviously, for the Hall of Fame right now. 32 of them are, you know, essentially assigned to the teams or team sites, you know, right? There's one representative from each, you know, reporter, essentially, that covers each team. And I'm the Detroit voter. And, you know, that voter is the person that's responsible for presenting the case, you know, for the hometown players. So it's my duty this year to present Kelvin Johnson's case to the Hall of Fame Selection Committee. And it's the very first one that I'll have presented. I think this is my, I don't know, sixth or seventh year on the committee. And, you know, certainly no Lions have come before Kelvin that I've had to talk about. But yeah, you know, as I told you before, you know, I am feeling a little bit of pressure. You know, Kelvin is, I mean, I think he's a Hall of Fame player. You know, and I realize it's not easy for wide receivers to get in the Hall of Fame on the first ballot, you know, before Randy Moss. I think the last receiver to do so was Jerry Rice. But, you know, I think Kelvin is worthy. And so, you know, I've spent on and off here for a couple months now researching his case. So I have every question answered, every possible thing I could say about Kelvin when it comes to the selection committee presentation the day before the Super Bowl.
Does he take offense to when people call him Megatron, or did he embrace that nickname?
No, I don't think he takes offense to it. I guess I've never really asked him that specifically, but no, I've never heard him take offense.
Yeah,
to that.
I mean, I never even thought about it. And I just thought about it right now for some reason, because you keep going back to Kelvin Johnson, and as fans, I think we spend more time calling the Megatron versus the Kelvin, which sucks because Megatron's the bad dude in that series, but he just invokes fear amongst the NFL when he was in the league. And I go back to that. That's the word I used earlier in our interview. And I think that's the biggest thing, is like, he's such a fear. Sure, it was a short time frame, but man, talk about uncoverable. You had to put three dudes on him. It doesn't matter, because Matty Snapback, he's just going to toss that ball and he's going to go up over three Cowboys. And that's the Hall of Fame good that I was going to talk about. Let's talk about the process of Matt Stafford's career. He's not a Hall of Famer right now. I don't think anybody would argue, but what would it take for him to get into recognition for maybe a Hall of Fame career, you think?
It's a good question. It's something I've asked people about before, written about before, because, you know, ultimately, you know, he's at least if he continues on the trajectory that he is, he's going to have the numbers. You know, he's going to rank as one of the top passers in NFL history. And, you know, a lot of times, I mean, those numbers are, you know, people do look at the numbers and say, you know, that person is worthy for the Hall of Fame. But I think especially when it comes to quarterbacks, you know, wins are important, and not just winning games, winning championships, winning, you know, playoff games, division titles. You know, Matthew has none of those so far in 12 seasons. Contending for an MVP award. I mean, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I've written a story before about this, that I want to say there's 26 or 27 quarterbacks in the Hall of Fame. And maybe 21 of them have won a Super Bowl championship before. And of the other, you know, five or six, like four of those have won MVP awards, you know? So in order to be a quarterback in the Hall of Fame, you know, you have to have, especially what I talk about, you know, being considered one of the best at your position in the NFL for some period of time. And that's the thing that, you know, right now is going to hold Matthew back. You know, obviously he does not have the playoff wins. He does not have the MVP awards, the Super Bowls. So when you look at him, do you say he's one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL? Well, I don't think, you know, early in his career, you know, obviously it's been Aaron Rodgers. It's been Tom Brady, Peyton Manning, you know, and then now it's Patrick Mahomes and Lamar Jackson and, you know, Russell Wilson and some of those guys. So I think Matthew, you know, unless he has some of that success on the field, I think it's going to be tough for him to get in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, this is me separating my fan versus the reporter side, I suppose. Yeah, he's probably not eligible. I just wonder if, like you said, 12 years there, say he plays for a career of 17 years, is 5 years enough to really make up? Like, he wins three Super Bowls, he goes on a three Super Bowl run. I wonder if that's enough to really bring everything together.
I think it would, because, you know, look, obviously he didn't have the team success early in his career, but, you know, if you look at things objectively, obviously he took over an 0-16 team, right? So, you know, some of the early success or lack of success doesn't, you know, that can be easily explained. You know, look, and frankly, the Lions organization has a history of being like this. I mean, you know, if he goes somewhere else next year and immediately experiences success, I think a lot of people will look at that like, well, it was the Lions holding him back. You know, so I think there's a lot that goes into a person's candidacy, and their whole career has to be taken into account. And when you have the bottom line numbers at the end of the day, you know, when you're going to rank as one of the top, you know, retire as one of the top passers in NFL history, then if you reach a Super Bowl or two, if you're in MVP contention, you know, then I think ultimately, you know, that might be enough to put him over the top.
You mentioned the, you know, at the, when he retires, he has all the, he'll have all the numbers and all these kinds of things. How, I don't even know if this, how it's possible, but how do you delineate as the generations change and the style of gameplay changes and the statistics, like right now they're out of control for various reasons. Like, how would you compare players from different eras?
Well, that's why, to me, it's important that when you see these guys, you say, you know, he's the best player of his era, because the numbers certainly don't match up, right? I mean, even going back to Kelvin's case, right? Kelvin played 9 years, and I think he ranks, you know, top 30 all-time in receiving yards, which is not much. But, you know, but the explosion of passing numbers here in the last few years, these guys that are going to pass him, I mean, there are so many wide receivers that are playing right now that are going to end up with better numbers than Kelvin Johnson when it comes to the end of their career. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be, you know, better players or more worthy of the Hall of Fame. So I think it's extremely important to look at, you know, the era that they play in. And for, at least for me, you know, the modern guys that we see play, if I can look at the, you know, those guys and say, yes, he's one of the best players of that era, then, ultimately, I have no problem putting him in the Hall of Fame. I mean, Roddy White has, you know, he has almost the same numbers as Kelvin when it comes to total yards. And I never looked at Roddy White the same way that I looked at Kelvin Johnson as a wide receiver. And I don't know, maybe that's, I was here, so maybe I'm not giving Roddy enough credit, but I tend to think that's, you know, a lot of people would share that viewpoint. So it's a lot more about bottom line. It's a lot more about the eye test and some of the ancillary things than it is just the numbers they put up.
Yeah, I think that in Roddy White's case, for instance, like, he was a great player, of course, had good numbers. You had Matt Ryan throwing him the ball, so a product of the system maybe. But then when Julio came in, like, Calvin Johnson would not have become a 1B like the first year that a new rookie comes in, unless he's like, you know, 39 years old, that's a different story, but in his still almost prime of his career. So I think that's a delineation there between the two.
I'm looking at the list, not to interrupt you. I'm looking at the list. Kelvin Johnson is 31st in all-time receiving yards. And right behind him are Musin Muhammad, Rod Smith, Keenan McCardell. I mean, you know, again, those are the peers that he's with number wise, but you know, he is not within that peer group as a player,
agree, yeah.
I don't think. And I know those guys played, you know, all three of those guys had longer careers, so they had more time to put up numbers, but that's why it's important to look beyond just the numbers.
I mean, going back to our Madden discussion that we brought up, but not one of those guys would have ever been considered to be, okay, you're going to be on the Madden cover, and legitimately you could have been on the Madden cover every year, that kind of thing. It's just a longevity, which kind of brings us back to an older, the senior class. There's a player that's tied for fifth all-time in interceptions, old Cincinnati Bengals player, Ken Riley. He has 65. And that's one of the arguments, is that he hasn't been in because of his longevity of his career for 15 years. I mean, have you ever talked about him in your discussions?
No, so this is what happens with the senior players a lot of times, right? There is a seniors selection committee, essentially, you know, on the greater Hall of Fame committee that weighs all of the senior candidates before they come to a vote. And it's their job, those five or seven people, they are the ones who vet all of the candidates. They talk to all the you know, NFL personnel, coaches, whoever it may be, former players, to figure out, you know, out of this list of, it's just, it's very much like our process when we take 15 players, or we start with a list of 125 players, then you vote for 25, and that sort of gives you your semifinalists. And then out of that 25, everyone picks 15, and there's 15 finalists. Well, the senior committee does that specifically with the veterans players. They take this massive list of players that may have been overlooked, and then they whittle that down to 15, and then they go through each of those 15 candidates and determine which one is the best one to present to the greater Hall of Fame selection committee. So when it comes to Ken Riley, I certainly know the name, but you know, it's interesting because Charles Woodson is the guy that he's tied with, and he's going to be, you know, Woodson will be a first ballot Hall of Famer this year, but we've never discussed Ken Riley in the room, at least when I've been a part of this, because he has not got through that senior committee vetting process.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. You have a group of dedicated, they have more experience with it, and then they vet who to get into the room for everyone to vote on. Now, the ones that do get into that room, so there's, how many did you say would make it into the room for you to vote on?
So years past, there's been one or two. It's alternated based. Maybe that one year there's one senior player, one year there's two contributors. This year, I believe it's one senior player is on the ballot.
And then you are all voting for basically to say yay or nay to get the individual in the Hall of Fame?
Yeah. So, you know, just again, some of the insight on the process, right? When we get the 15 players, the 15 modern era finalists, everyone picks their top 10. It's not just a straight vote of who's the five you want, right? Terrell Owens, for instance, I would have put T.O. in on my first ballot. He didn't get enough votes, and I don't even believe he got enough votes to get in that top 10. So then from the top 10, everyone votes for a top five, and then the top five, it's a yay or nay on the top five. So that's why it's sort of, you know, a lot of people like to compare it to baseball. Well, you didn't vote for Terrell Owens. Well, I didn't have the opportunity to vote for Terrell Owens, you know, so it's I would have put him in first ballot, but he didn't get enough votes in the process to be in that final five. With the seniors committee player, they've already gone through that process. So the seniors committee player, the contributor, now the coach, those are just a simple yes or no vote.
Okay. So the process is, otherwise it's not like you could sit there and vote on 35 players in that one meeting. Otherwise it'd be all day.
Those meetings take, you know, 10 hours as they are when we're discussing 18 people, you know, and you know, maybe if it's a Peyton Manning this year, it's going to be a 2-minute discussion because everyone knows that he belongs in. But, you know, for Kelvin, it may end up being a 30-minute discussion because there will be some debate as well. Is he worthy of a first ballot nomination? You know, so there's a lot that goes into that discussion.
Yeah. Man, I can't remember if it was Rick Goslin or Clark Judge, one of the two, when I was interviewing them, I asked everybody like what's their definition of a Hall of Famer. Then I asked them what the first ballot for some reason. And, well, it was because of Kelvin Johnson. That's why I asked him if he thought he should be a first ballot. And he said that like for him, it's someone when they stand up and they're able to just say the name. He said, you stand up and you say Barry Sanders and you sit down and everybody, no, you don't have to try to argue for him. He's like, that's a no brainer, kind of no doubt. Like, I guess that's probably what a Peyton Manning would be this year, for instance.
The only player that I've seen do that in my career is Brett Favre. You know, that I think Brett Favre was about an 8-second discussion where, you know, it was a long day and somebody said, look, you know, it's Brett Favre. We all know Brett Favre belongs in the Hall of Fame, and, you know, kind of sat down and it was, you know, does anybody have any questions, anything to add? Do we need to talk about him? And everybody sort of agreed. And so it was, he got in. I think Peyton Manning gets in like that this year. I don't think that necessarily defines a first ballot Hall of Famer, because one of the issues that I have is, you know, trying to say somebody's a Hall of Fame worthy, but not first ballot Hall of Fame worthy. I mean, they're either worthy or they're not, right? It's you can't be halfway pregnant sort of thing, right? You're either a Hall of Fame caliber player or you're not. And whether you get in on the first ballot or not is something entirely different, you know, and that's about who else is in the class and who else is, you know, you're competing for votes with, both in the group at large and at your position. And I think Peyton and Charles Woodson will walk in this year, and that leaves three spots, three of the five modern era spots that would still be left. And again, I think Kelvin is worthy of one of those, whether he gets it or not. You know, I can't tell you, just because I think there's, you know, there's plenty of other viable candidates out there. You know, Tony Baselli and John Lynch, I'm sure, will have, you know, a lot of people pushing for him this year because he's had a long wait. And so there's, I think he's deserving of it. I hope he gets in year one. But I also know the numbers for first ballot Hall of Fame receivers and realize that he might have to wait a year or two.
Right. I mean, you mentioned John Lynch. Now that he's really done a pretty good job, I'd say, over there with the general manager duties, does that end up when a player transitions get taken into effect or account at all, or is it just career specific on their field?
Yeah, it does not. It's never talked about in the room. I mean, it may be mentioned, right? Like, hey, you know, it'd be a, you know, he's like last year, for instance, right? 49ers are in the Super Bowl. I'm sure it had to cross people's minds, like, you know, what a weekend it would be if he gets in the Hall of Fame
right.
and wins the Super Bowl in the same weekend. So there's, you know, there's a human element to it. I guess you certainly know what he's done, you know, in his second career. But that was not discussed in the room at all. Well, you know, we also need to take into account that he, you know, what he's done in San Francisco and building that team into a Super Bowl contender, that's not discussed at all. It's solely for what happens between the lines as a player.
Yeah. I mean, if anything, it's like a kind of the Ozzie Newsome where he probably could legitimately be in the Hall for contributor and the player. So you mentioned like kind of going back to that whole, the story piece, and it would have been a great, cool story. What story from history would you write on the NFL if you had the chance to just write a story, maybe even make a book or a movie about it?
From the history of the NFL?
Yeah, there hasn't been anything that's like, you know, this was so cool, not enough people know about this. Man, I'm going to dig into this, you know, dive on my weekends as a fun project.
Man, that's deep because it's a lot of years to go back in the NFL and a lot of things to think about. I mean, you know, look, I think, and it's, you know, when you look back at the early days of the NFL, and maybe not the early days, but the 50s, the 60s, you know, the 40s, you know, sort of as the league was coming of age. I mean, you know, I've read a couple books. Joe Horgan, the former, he used to work for the Hall of Fame, you know, pro football historian. He wrote a great book sort of on the first 100 years of the NFL. You know, I was reading a Vince Lombardi book this offseason and just, you know, learning some of that stuff. I, you know, doing a deep dive, there's probably not enough interest in our readership to do something like that. But, you know, it would be fascinating to be around at that time and kind of knowing what we know now about where the NFL is and the direction that it's taken, to see the integration of the league, to see the growth of the league from a television standpoint. You know, I mean, frankly, you know, to the way that the league was covered back then versus what it is now, you know, where reporters were much more friendly with their subjects and traveled with the teams. And, you know, you didn't have the instant news on the internet. So I would, if I could go back in time, you know, I guess, you know, plopping me into at some point in that era, the 57 Lions, since I covered them, would be a great one to chronicle. But, you know, I think there's probably a lot of challenges to that too, that I'm not quite realizing as well.
Yeah, I'm sure it's a different era, like you said. And I mean, even some of our past previous Hall of Fame voters that were NFLB reporters, they talked about that very thing, how it's changed to where they would go in, and I forget what year it would have been, but it was a year Terry Bradshaw came back off of knee injury, and Clark Judge walks into the press conference where you and me now, like one of the biggest name in the sport, you know, forget about Peyton Manning coming back from that neck surgery. You're in the back of the thing hoping they can hear you. He's like, it was me and one other guy. I could ask him whatever question I wanted. He was wide open with everything. It's just totally different.
You know, it's funny because people have said that at the combine, right? Like, I remember going to the combine, my first combine. I probably went in 2008, I think, was my first combine. I went for the Oakland Press back then. And, you know, there used to be this small little room in the Indianapolis Convention Center. It was right when you walked in from where the hotels are. If anyone's been to Indianapolis, a big convention center surrounded by all these hotels, and there's sort of walkways that lead the hotels into the convention center. And then you got to walk basically the length of the convention center to get to Lucas Oil Stadium now, the old RCA Dome. where the combine takes place. And there was this tiny room that was set up, and because there was probably, 100 reporters maybe that would go when I first started going, and there's several hundred, 1,000, whatever it is right now. And my very first combine, Mike O'Hara, I'll never forget. He was outside one of the rooms super early in the morning waiting for people just to, say hi. And me being the young cub reporter that I am, I was like, oh, that's a pretty good idea. I'm going to do the same thing. So I would get up at 7 a.m. And stand just outside this room, and people would come by and you'd introduce yourself or talk to them, say hi. But there was no crush of people like there is now. Now you go to the combine in Indianapolis and we're not in the conventions. Well, we are back in the convention center now, but there are huge rooms set up. At one point it moved over to the stadium. Now there's huge rooms set up in the convention center, one on the second floor that's massive, that's sort of the workroom. And the players have, very scheduled times. The personnel people have very scheduled times to talk. It is just, in the 10 years essentially that I've been going to the combine, the change is it just boggles the mind how big it's become. And so having seen that, I can only imagine what it would have been like in the 50s, 60s, 70s to cover a game, cover a season, cover an event like that Bradshaw one.
Hey, yeah, it would have been totally different. I mean, I had guys talk to me about how it was like they had free reign. They would go into the coach's office and just drink his coffee and just talk to him like every morning. It's just like totally different. Speaking of going back in old time, I do have an article that, speaking of your, how hard it would be that I gathered, 10 or 11 experts on, each one of them was like an expert on the original NFL team. So we covered all 14 teams. They had a little blurb. I put it into like a 2-hour podcast or something like that. And then the article itself. So I'll send that to you just in case you're interested in it. It was like the biggest project I ever worked on. So it was just fun to get through it. And I have one last that we got to give you the virtual keys to the DeLorean there, Dave. I'm going to go back in time anywhere you want to go. Maybe not cover a game because you've already talked about that. But as a fan, what game are you going to go to?
Ooh, as a fan, what game am I going to go to? It'd be the first Super Bowl, I think. Because then I'd have the ticket stub and the program and whatever, and I could probably make a mint off it on eBay, right? But no, just to sort of see that. I mean, that was really the inception of the NFL, right? When those two leagues came together to play the very first Super Bowl. And I think that would be awesome to, be a part of that history. I do sometimes think about that now when it comes to historical artifacts or whatnot, right? Like, it'd be cool to have something from the 57 Lions just to, like a ring, right? Like a Joe Schmidt, when, he's got that memory of that, and his kids will forever have his artifacts of that time when football was, it didn't mean as much, nationally as it does now. And so, there were so few people that were associated with it. To be at the root of that, I think would be, on some level, obviously his kids weren't around then, but on some level, to have your own, handprints, on that, would be amazing. And for me, the 57 Lions championship game would be a great one, but I think the first Super Bowl, just for all it's meant to the history of the game, kind of where we are now, what that thing has become, what the Super Bowl has become, that, again, to knowing what it is now, to see what it would have been like back then, I think that would just be fascinating in itself, because the Super Bowl is such a production now. There's so little that goes on that's about the game, and to be around that back in the day would be pretty sweet.
Yeah, it'd be hard to argue against that one, going to the first Super Bowl and that guy in the rocket, shooting himself up at halftime. Speaking of the 57 championship, I did have Gene Cronin, who was one of the players on the team at that time.
Yes, I've talked to him plenty of times. Yeah,
he talked about how at the San Francisco game at halftime, how they were down by however many points it was, and the coach got up and they were instead of giving a speech, he's like, I was going to give you a speech, because they were like, old school. They were like in a high school locker room. Yep. They could, you hear that story too?
Absolutely. Now, it's great that you bring that up. We did a big piece on the 57 Lions in 2017. It was a 60-year anniversary. And so we tried to bring I think we ended up with 10 members of the team, including one, you know, front office guy. But we tried to get as many living members as possible for like a reunion. And Gene came out, and they all, we sat around for, about 2 hours at a restaurant, Bloomfield Hills, and just had them tell stories and shot some videos. And that was one of them that came up, where they would sit in the, you know, they went into the locker room and you could hear through the paper thin walls what the 49ers were saying. And one guy's buying his wife a car and, you know, whatever. They're talking about how they're spending their money from, you know, going to the Super Bowl. And that was essentially, you know, what motivated the Lions, I guess. Hearing that was enough to propel them to the big second half they had. That's a great story for sure.
Yeah. I'm going to have to check that out. Do you have links or anything like that? YouTube or any?
Absolutely. If you Google it, it's still all out there. Just Google, you know, 57 Lions, 60 year anniversary Free Press, something like that. And I'm sure it'll come up, because that was a cool project that we did. It was just one of those things where it was like, you know what, there's not going to be much time to get these guys together. We got Joe Schmidt was out there, Don Dibble before he passed away. Gene Cronin flew in from California. Steve Junker drove up from Ohio. I'm trying to, Roger Zatkoff was there. There were probably 9 or 10 former players and front office people, I guess. And it was just great to have them sit around and tell their stories and, you know, kind of hear that little bit of football history, you know, not being a part of it, but just hear the stories that they had. So we shot, you know, I don't, the whole video is probably not up. I don't think we put all, you know, 2 hours or whatever it was online, but we definitely, there's definitely a nice video that's up online. And I know we all wrote a couple stories off the experience. So that's somewhere floating around on the interwebs for everyone.
All right. Well, I'll definitely leave that in the show notes for everybody. I'll find it. And speaking of show notes and finding people, if anybody wanted to get a hold of Dave Burkett or they wanted to look at your work, where would they go?
Yeah, you know, just check out freep.com, freep.com. I think most Lions fans know that. And you can always follow me on Twitter at Dave Burkett, B-I-R-K-E-T-T. Happy to try to answer questions. Don't get to them all. Sometimes I get a little bogged down with what's going on with the kids and don't get around to answering things, and they stack up a little too high, but I always try to interact with people on there too.
How about that? How often do you get to hear the background of somebody that's about to present a player to be nominated for the Pro Football Hall of Fame? And this is their first time doing so. I mean, personally, I really enjoyed it. You know, I'm a Detroit Lions fan, local guy here, and I hope you enjoyed the show as well. If you did, I sure would appreciate it if you would leave a rating and a review about the show in your favorite podcast player choice. Or put them in all the podcast apps if you want, especially if it's 5 stars, you know what I mean? And don't forget to also subscribe for free to the show by mashing the little subscribe button on your podcast player choice. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Football History Dude. To make sure you're the first to get the next episode, please subscribe on your podcast player of choice and head on over to thefootballhistorydude.com for the show notes and more information on the history of the NFL. And remember, dudes, where we're going, we don't need roads.